So we're looking together at John chapter 2 and the first 11 verses on page 887, if you find it helpful to have the Bible open. John chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. What's the happiest occasion, you've ever been to? What was the best thing that you've attended or been to? Certainly weddings are often usually very happy, aren't they? Today's account from John's Gospel takes place at a wedding. Now, what's the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you? What's the most awful thing that's ever happened or almost happened to you? I won't linger there. You probably don't want to think on it. In today's story, a most happy occasion almost turned into a supremely embarrassing one. The note of disaster is sounded in verse 3. The wine ran out. Imagine inviting all of your colleagues, work colleagues, to a swish city centre restaurant for a leaving do, and they all turn up to find out that you hadn't booked the table or checked and it was actually closed for refurbishment. Come from all around, and there you are outside. Or imagine you offered to drive a family to the airport for their holiday of a lifetime, but you forgot to show up. Imagine that. It's a fairly major oversight. And the problem in today's story was at least as bad as that. Weddings in Jesus' culture could last for days and days, even as much as a week. And it was a time of celebration when the whole village would get together. This wasn't a sort of private function after the registry office. This was a great village social gathering. The bridegroom was responsible for the supply of wine, and to run out would be deeply shameful. There might even be serious repercussions from the humiliated bride's family. And this was the situation. It looked like this occasion would be remembered for generations for all the wrong reasons. But it wasn't. The situation was saved. And in fact, more than saved, it was completely turned round because Jesus was there. Now, all sorts of details in this account sort of cry out for our attention. Why has John pinpointed the timing? He starts, doesn't he, on the third day. And what about the location? Cana in Galilee. Is there something significant about the place? Certainly the time and the place link us back to chapter 1. Back in chapter 1 and verse 43, Jesus had planned to go to Galilee, presumably for this occasion. And John seems to start counting days from chapter 1 and verse 29 onwards, making this day 6 or maybe day 7. Is that significant? And then there's this strange exchange between Jesus and his mother. It's very hard to capture the feel of that opening word, woman. It's not quite how it sounds in English, and yet it's not rude, but it's not warm either. It's certainly putting a distance between Jesus and his mother, which is then underlined by the following words. Something of a rebuke, it seems. And what does Jesus mean? My hour has not yet come. What hour? And why then does Jesus go on to act as if the time was right? And then there's those 6 water jars. Is the number 6 significant? Does it match day 6? What about the reference to the sort of purification, ceremonial washing of the Jews? Certainly we get a feel for the sheer quantity of wine, don't we? 20 to 30 gallons in each of these huge containers, and 6 of them. It was enough for the whole village to celebrate for as long as they wanted, and for the new couple to start on a better financial footing. Presumably they were poor, hence this lack of wine, but no longer with this resource. And it's quantity and quality. That comes out, doesn't it, in the approving words of the master of the feast. The master of the feast was a sort of like the best man and the father of the bride and the catering company all rolled into one. And he said, doesn't he? He calls the bridegroom over. You know, normally the best wine comes out first. Impress with that first drink. And when the guests are in a good mood, feeling expansive, then you can sort of bring out, you know, you put the sort of, start with the apple teas, but you make sure you've got lots of 2-litre bottles of lemonade for the end of the barn dance or whatever it is. It's that sense. And yet, he says, wow. You've completely surprised us. You brought out this top-notch, good wine. It's coming out now. You've saved the best until last. But does John want us to read more into that? A deeper significance than the master of the feast intended. Certainly, John is a very sophisticated writer. But what are we to make of it all? Where should we start? Well, if we want to understand the significance of this story, what it means, then the best place to start is John's commentary, John's description at the end of it. This is one of the things that makes John's gospel different from the other gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John frequently adds his own comments to the history that he relates. That gives this story a sort of a double punchline. You've got the words in verse 10 of the master of the feast. You've kept the good wine until now. And then you have John's comment in verse 11 there on the screen. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. And his disciples believed in him. And so those words will give us our three points for this morning. Firstly then, John tells us that this is Jesus' first sign. This is Jesus' first sign. So this is a sign. There is something deeply significant. That's what a sign is. It shows that something is significant. Signs point to things. More than that, it's the first sign. And when, you know, when John says this was Jesus' first sign, he's encouraging you, isn't he, to start counting. There'll be more signs. What will they be? How many? What are they for? We have to keep reading to the end of chapter 4 to get to the next sign. In chapter 4 and verse 46, Jesus came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. A flashback. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. And so John describes how Jesus healed that man's son from a distance. And then at the end of chapter 4, this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. 1, 2. John doesn't give us any more numbers, but he's got us going. He wants us to count. A crippled man healed. A picnic multiplied to feed a great host of people, rather like the multiplied wine. A man who was born blind, who now sees. A dead man raised. Signs are a big deal in John's gospel. In next week's reading, we're going to read the angry religious leaders demanding of Jesus, what sign do you show us for doing these things? Jesus is going to do something which is going to raise all sorts of hackles. And they're going to ask him, what sign do you do? And then we'll read, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But interestingly, Jesus wouldn't entrust himself to them. They entrusted themselves to Jesus, but it wasn't mutual. And there's going to be many more intriguing references to signs throughout this book of John. And almost the last reference to signs in the book of John is very sad. In chapter 12 and verse 37, we read, though Jesus had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. Though Jesus had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. I'm not talking this morning about the historicity of this sign. When Jesus was doing his miracles, even his most hostile enemies couldn't deny that he was doing them. Instead, they blamed him on using occult powers. There was no doubt that Jesus was doing some remarkable things. And yet they didn't believe in him. Just as we read in chapter 1, he came to his own, but his own did not receive him. And that's the last reference to signs for 8 long chapters. And then almost at the end, at the very climax of John's gospel, there's one last reference. Full of hope. John chapter 20 and verse 30. Jesus did many other signs, many more than in John's gospel, in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's what it's all for. That's what these signs are for. That's why John has written them down, so that people might believe Jesus is the Messiah, that he's God's Son, and that believing that they might have life, true life, abundant life, eternal life through him in his name. And so that takes us to our second point. Second point is that his disciples believe in him. This is Jesus' first sign, and his disciples believe in him. Remember our key verse at the end of chapter 2 and verse 11? This, the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and his disciples believed in him. Disciples believe in him. Now, believing is a huge theme in John's Gospel. The Greek word for believe or trust occurs 98 times in John. And that's more than all the occurrences in all the rest of the New Testament put together. 98 times John uses his verb for believe or trust. That was why John the Baptist came. Remember back in chapter 7. John the Baptist came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through him. Believing, incredibly, is how you can be adopted into God's family. Verse 12, but to all who did receive him, 12 of verse 1 of chapter 1, to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. That was where we ended last week. Chapter 1 and verse 50, Jesus answered Nathanael, because I said to you, I saw you under this fig tree, do you believe? Jesus showed Nathanael that he knew all about him, and Nathanael expressed his belief. Jesus said, you're going to see many more things than this, some of which are recorded in John's Gospel. It's all about believing in Jesus. Now, not just believe in his words, not just believe in that Jesus is trustworthy or reliable in what he says, but in trusting yourself to him. It's believing in him, or even literally believing into him. It's about relying on someone, putting your confidence in them, depending upon them. This was the point of the sign, that they might put their trust in Jesus. That was the effect that it had on the first followers. His disciples believe in him. And John wants his gospel to have that same effect. He wants it to have that same effect on subsequent readers and hearers, even on us today. This is Jesus' first sign. His disciples believe in him. But what exactly did this sign point to? Signs point. What did it point to? What was it that prompted their trust? Well, that's the third thing in John's summary verse. Jesus reveals his glory. Jesus reveals his glory. By acting in this way, Jesus puts his glory, his splendor, on display, at least for his disciples to see, though not in general. But his disciples see. They see what has happened. They're party to what's gone on behind the scenes. Jesus reveals his glory. Now, this theme of glory is another key theme in John. You see what's happening. John is sort of setting up his gospel, as he did in his prologue in the early part of chapter 1, and now at the beginning of chapter 2, he's setting up these themes of signs and of belief and of glory. We had that key word for glory in that key verse in chapter 1 and verse 14. The Word became flesh. The Word, God's self-expression, who has always been, became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So how exactly do we see Jesus' glory in what happened? Well, for one thing, there's the miracle itself. It seems so effortless, doesn't it? It's not as if Jesus even touches the jars. He doesn't pray. He doesn't do anything like that. He just speaks. And it is like God in the beginning. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. You know, actually, God has been turning water into wine all through human history, hasn't he? sends the rain, the rain comes, causes the grapes to grow, the vines, and all the amazing chemical processes that happen in fermentation. That's all God's idea. God turning water to wine. It's just Jesus does it more quickly and without any equipment. The whole process, even the natural process, is astonishingly complex and incredible. So Jesus repeats that. Astonishing. There's this miracle itself which draws attention to Jesus and his glory. But there's a second way that we see Jesus' glory. And that's in that surprising exchange between Jesus and his mother. Jesus is not following any human agenda. Jesus is going to work in his own time and his own way. And this is something that Mary has to learn. Unsurprisingly, Mary had come to rely on her remarkable son. We don't know what she expected Jesus to do. This was his first miracle. Only that she'd always found him to be resourceful and reliable and wise and kind. Crisis. Mary would turn to her son. But now she needed to know that now that his public ministry had begun, God alone was going to be setting his agenda. Mary doesn't have an inside track with Jesus. Now, sometimes Roman Catholics use this exchange to support their unbiblical practice of praying to Mary. With the idea that sort of Mary will ask Jesus to do something for you and you get some leverage that way. Well, these verses teach us the very opposite. Mary goes to Jesus and she has a rebuke. Gentle, but true. Mary has no more influence with Jesus than anyone else. We never pray to anyone except to the Lord, except to God the Father, through the Lord Jesus Christ, except to the Lord himself. Not to Mary, not to saints. The best way to honor Mary is not to pray to her, but to follow her advice in verse 5. Whatever he says, do it. Do whatever he tells you. We honor, that's good advice, isn't it? So Jesus is not following any human agenda. We see the miracle that reveals his glory. We see his independence. He's not tame. He's not domesticated. But nor is he in any way unwilling or reluctant. We see his compassion and we see his provision. We've already commented, haven't we, on the quantity and the quality of the wine. It wasn't just, as it were, a sort of stopgap measure. This event would be remembered for generations for all the right reasons, that it just would go on and on. There would be this enjoyment and the quality of the wine. It has compassion. We started, didn't we? It wasn't a small thing, this running out of wine. It wasn't a sort of a minor hitch in an otherwise successful wedding reception. This was at the very heart. This would have been a complete disaster, and yet Jesus has compassion. Shows his compassion and he provides. The word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Full of grace, full of generosity, full of kindness, as full indeed as full as those six water jars were. But there's something more. There's a further indication of Jesus' glory. Here in this first miracle, we get a profound hint of Jesus' role in God's plan. Every sign in John's gospel points to something about Jesus. When Jesus heals the official's son in chapter 4, it shows how he brings true health, moral health, spiritual health. When Jesus cures the lame man in chapter 5, he shows that he can make us walk properly. In the deeper sense of how we walk through life, how we live our lives. Jesus can put that right, even though we're lame by nature. Feeding the 5,000 shows that he alone can truly satisfy. Walking on water shows that he is the master of unruly nature. Opening a blind man's eyes shows us how he opens our eyes spiritually to see things as they truly are. And raising Lazarus from the dead shows his power over the final and greatest enemy, death itself. All of these signs point us to something about Jesus, a rescue from jeopardy to health, from helplessness to walking aright, from hunger to satisfaction, from darkness to light, from death to life, and from shame to joy. That's the significance of this sign, the glory of Jesus' role in what he will achieve a rescue from shame to joy. As a human race, we are in a desperately shameful position. Just a glance at the news should tell us as much, shouldn't it? See of how we treat one another. A good, honest look at our own hearts reveals the same truth, just as Andrew prayed. We just don't have what we need. And it's deeply shameful. It's a minor oversight. But Jesus can make up that lack. Now, don't hear me wrong. Jesus is not some sort of magic charm for health and wealth and prosperity. You don't need to travel very far to find churches that are going to peddle such lies. Jesus is not a magic charm. Jesus doesn't guarantee to fix all of our problems. Jesus acts in God's time according to God's agenda and not ours. Mary had to learn that, and so do we. Jesus is not tame. Jesus is not domesticated. Jesus has far bigger plans for us than a clean bill of health or a fat bank balance. To all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. That's what Jesus comes to do. It's what we read about when we opened our meeting last week. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. He who has no money, come buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way. The unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him. For he will abundantly pardon. This is what Jesus comes to bring. Forgiveness. Life in his name. Soul satisfaction. Adoption into God's family. And God has a plan for the whole cosmos, not just individuals. We saw, didn't we, the time before last, how John the Baptist stood on the brink of a new age. The Old Testament was like those water jars full of purification. They're associated, aren't they, with ritual and ceremonial purification. And the blessing that Jesus came to bring is as different from the Old Testament as the wine was from the water that started in the jars. That's what the master of the feast was saying, though he didn't know it. You've kept the best until now. Jesus came to bring in God's kingdom. And one day he will bring it in all its fullness. We started, didn't we, with that reading from Isaiah 25. On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine. Of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined, the sort of idea of a feast, not just the removal of death, but it's the all joy and all provision. Or take this prophecy from Amos chapter 9. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. The mountain shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. They shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. It's Old Testament language for a great, glorious future reality for all God's people. This is what Jesus came to do. One day the shameful lack, not just of one wedding in Cana, but of the whole cosmos, will be made good. And by the same person who revealed his glory on that day at Cana. And in that sense, it's a very fitting first miracle, since it points to the final climax of history. It points us to the age to come. As John will say in his final book, this is his gospel, but he also authored the book of Revelation. John says, Revelation 19, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. These are the true words of God. A little relator, he writes, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, and it's an Old Testament language for New Testament realities, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. This city that comes down from heaven is the church, it's all God's people, finally made what we should be, a bride adorned for her husband. And who is the husband? Well, he's the one who provides the wine. So this is Jesus' first sign. His disciples believe in him, and Jesus reveals his glory. He reveals his glory in the miracle itself, in his compassion and his provision, and as he hints at his role in God's plan. But as we close, I want to return to Jesus' words, "My hour has not yet come." That's what he said, isn't it, to his mother. They've got no wine. He said, "Woman, why do you involve me? What's this to do with me? My hour has not yet come." We're going to be hearing more about Jesus' hour in John's Gospel. In chapter 7, we read, they were seeking to arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. We get the same in chapter 8. But then in chapter 12, verse 23, Jesus says about himself, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." Now, isn't that interesting? In chapter 2, Jesus reveals his glory, but not fully. In fact, there is something so glorious in John's Gospel that John can say in chapter 7, even after a number of astounding miracles, Jesus was not yet glorified. He can say that. Jesus was not yet glorified. Haven't seen anything yet. So what is Jesus' supreme glory when his hour finally comes? Let's go back to John 12. "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Jesus is talking about his death. Now, how is that glorious? Because that is how he rescues us from shame to joy, by bearing our shame for us. This is the moment of Jesus' glory, or rather, it's the moment that his glory begins, which continues unendingly through the ages. The moment that Jesus shows us how much he loves us. On the cross, Jesus took the shame that we deserved, our shameful situation, he took it on himself. The guilt, punishment for our sin, and there he bore it, and he paid for it, he exhausted it at the cross for all those who will put their faith in him. It's his precious blood shed for those who will trust him, that purchases for us the unending joy of the age to come, the wine of the great banquet that we read about in Isaiah 25. Jesus has provided it through his shed blood. We see his glory displayed at the cross, so much brighter than even this wedding at Cana. And as we do so, may God enable you to believe in him. To believe in him, as his first disciples did. To come to him, whether for the first time or for the thousandth time. And to receive the wine of his love, his joy, all those gallons and gallons of it. Amen. Let's close with a song as we sing together. "You laid aside your majesty," a song which celebrates the Lord Jesus, who gave up so much for us that we might have all the blessings that come to us through him. "You laid aside your majesty." Ruth, we haven't sung this one since I've been around. So Ruth will play it all the way through. It's got a verse and a chorus, and then we'll stand and we'll sing it through. We'll sing it through twice. So just stay seated and then just listen to it.